Welcome to Real Vision. It's Monday, October 19, 2020, just after market close in New York. This is the Real Vision Daily Briefing. I'm Ash Bennington, joined shortly by our managing editor, Ed Harrison. But first, the day's stories with Jack Farley.
Thanks, Ash. U.S. equities faltered today, with all three major indices down and biopharma and real estate down the most. Particularly mall REITs are feeling the pain. CBL Properties on Friday announced that it would skip a debt payment. And Pennsylvania Real Estate Investment Trust is on the brink of bankruptcy. The residential real estate market, on the other hand, is by all apparent signs continuing to roar, with the NAHB Housing Market Index posting a strong reading of 85 today, ahead of the 83 that was expected. The equities that are up today, that are in fact leading the market, are actually the reopening stocks like United Airlines, Norwegian Cruises, and Royal Caribbean Cruises. Royal Caribbean announced a deal on Friday to secure an additional $1 billion in financing, both in common equity as well as in convertible bonds. In other news, the Nasdaq bears are taking their foot off the gas pedal. Traders had piled on short positions in late September, but over the past week, net speculative positions in Nasdaq mini futures surged by the most since 2007. And lastly, movie exhibitor Cineworld continues its search for financing, whereas its American competitor, AMC, is rallying as New York State is set to allow theaters to reopen this Friday. Betting on a continued reopening proves to be a high-risk, high-reward trade, especially as COVID-19 infections accelerate in Europe and the U.S. I know Ed and Ash have a lot of thoughts about how the ongoing pandemic will affect the economy, so let's go back to them. Ash?
Thanks, Jack. Welcome back, Ed.
Looking good, Billy Ray.
Looking good, Lewis.
Hey, you know, I see what I got for you here. It was sent to me. I just got it today in the mail by one of our lovely subscribers. It's a shirt. So, when I say what I'm supposed to say, which is looking good, Billy Ray, you're supposed to say feeling good, Lewis.
You know,
thank
I had
you for this present.
I had no idea you had that on underneath your jacket, and mine, I guess, has yet to arrive.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of funny because mine was sent from New York to D.C. and yours was sent from New York to New York, but I got mine.
Stuck in the package room, maybe. We'll have to find out.
Yeah, that's probably it.
Well done, sir. Well done. So, Ed, what are you looking at today?
Yeah, so I'm looking at the Chinese GDP numbers. I'm looking at some of the data out of Europe saying that there's a potential double dip there. And then I'm trying to put it all together to think about, you know, what this means for Q4 and Q1 and also coronavirus as the backdrop for all of that.
And how are you putting it all together?
Yeah, you know, the way that I'm putting it together is that it's the novel coronavirus pandemic and how various countries have fared economically, and what policies they put into place to control the virus that is really driving a lot of the narrative that we see now, both in terms of how, for instance, the Europeans might go into a double dip, and also how well the Chinese are doing relative to expectations, say, 3 to 6 months ago. And yeah. So I think that that's really how I'm thinking about it. And then you can extrapolate that out to the United States, which we can do at some point later on in the conversation.
Yeah. And it's a combination of healthcare policy and economic / industrial / corporate / business policy in all of those places that lead to not just the healthcare outcomes, but also the economic outcomes.
Yeah. And, you know, I wrote up a post on my site, a newsletter article, just sort of to put some thought to it. And I think that generally speaking, the framing that I'm thinking about is that, how I put this in April of 6 months ago, and I think the framework still works. The question is what is the sort of the paradigm to think about in terms of how you can achieve minimal economic disruption from COVID-19? And I think that a lot of countries have done well, some countries are doing better than others. And what we're going to see in this second wave of coronavirus is that there's going to be a real differentiation in terms of how countries are doing. And that's definitely going to see Asia, in my view, do better relative to countries in, say, Europe or North America.
Yeah. And to put an exclamation point on that, perhaps, another off day, U.S. Equities. So we see S&P 500 down one spot, 6.3% to 34.26 here today. The Dow off 1.44%, closing at 28.195.
So, going back to the whole concept, Ash, of where this takes us in terms of the numbers that are related to coronavirus, it's the numbers that came out of China overnight. And it's the Chinese economy. They're showing us what happens when you take the pandemic seriously. And also, obviously, when you throw in some debt-fueled stimulus for a good measure, just at a macro level, the Chinese gross domestic product rose 4.9% in Q3. Compared to the same quarter in 2019. That's faster than the second quarter rise of 3.2% over the year ago period, although it is somewhat below the 5.5% forecasted rise for economists that Bloomberg asked. Bloomberg said that I think makes sense is that the economy expanded 0.7% in the year, meaning that the world's second largest economy regained all of the ground it lost in the first half of the year. So, the economy went down in a massive way in the first half of the year, and now it's up 0.7% on the year to date. So that tells you that the Chinese have now recouped all of the losses from coronavirus, and now they're off back to the races again. And the reason obviously is that they've dealt with the coronavirus well. Before I stop, let me just give you some more info here. The New York Times said that, obviously it started with affluent people and people living in the export-oriented coastal economies. That is, after we went through the stimulus-led and infrastructure spending and industrial production-fueled growth, people in the affluent exported-oriented coastal provinces, they kicked in with their spending. But even in Wuhan, you see more consumer spending now. The New York Times was saying that you've had to line up to get into many restaurants in Wuhan. And for restaurants that are popular on the internet, the wait is 2 to 3 hours. And this is at the epicenter of where the coronavirus first emerged.
Yeah. There may be some net losses based on some of the foregone economic growth during the period that it was slowing. But look, China is basically back to trend. They're growing effectively. 30% of global economic growth is coming from China. 30%.
Yeah, that's an astounding amount. And by the way, the number, the 4.9% number was actually lower, largely because they had a massive import number. The number of imports that came into China was much higher than expected, which is a sign actually of growth. That is that they wanted more imports. They needed more imports because consumption growth had grown that much. So, the bottom line is that China has weathered the storm. Whether you think there's debt fueled growth there and it's infrastructure led. That doesn't matter at this point. The consumer is back in business in China and they're back to growing. And when you look at all the other countries in Asia, which have done really well in terms of the coronavirus pandemic, you have a whole block of countries that's doing really well and centered in some respects around China. There's a whole Asian block that's doing well. I know I spoke to Peter Buchbarb 2 or 3 weeks ago, and he was saying that if you had to take a long-term perspective about the coronavirus, he would be, long Asia because of exactly that reason.
Right. And for those of you who don't live the economic formulas the way that Ed does, GDP is C plus G plus I plus NX. So it's consumption, government spending, and the NX component is net exports. I is investment. NX is net exports, which is exports minus imports. And that's why the import number pulls GDP down when it rises.
Good. And it's good that you say that because just as an aside, we have two explainers that came out over the weekend from Roger Hearst and also from Stephen Van Meter. Yeah. And, I think that people really enjoyed the fact that you can break stuff down. Some of the people who are on the platform, we throw out concepts that they're not as familiar with. So it's always good to break it down for people.
Yeah. And, you know, the interesting thing to think about here, of course, is that we know that consumption declined, investment declined, and government spending is what's risen globally, as you said, the support that the Chinese and indeed in the U.S. that we got from fiscal policy.
Yeah. So the Chinese are back to where consumption is really the gangbusters part without the government spending to hold it up. Whereas right. in the United States, you know, consumption has risen significantly, but a lot of that has been fueled by transfer payments from the government.
Yeah. And I was struck by Jamie Dimon's comments, as we talked about on a prior episode of RVDB, that he basically starkly said that, look, this is being driven by government stimulus in the form of unemployment.
Yeah. How long can that last before you have an organic growth model? Well, the answer we see in China, as long as you get rid of the virus or you keep the virus at bay, largely at bay, it only has to last a little bit. But the longer, the worse you do in terms of virus mitigation, the more sort of localized shutdowns, the more economic disruption you're going to have. And the result is the more you might need government to have a make good on the lost consumption and the lost output as a result right. of that.
Yeah. And the declines from today that we were talking about, another time to throw in the amid speculation that there may not be a deal reached on stimulus. That's where markets are trading right now, pricing in whether or not government stimulus seems to be a high or low probability.
You know, I saw something about Dow Transports hitting a high level, and that's very bad. You know, the Dow theory in terms of what it says about the economy's rolling over. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Now, let me switch tacks for a second and talk to you a little bit about what's happening in Europe, because there's been a lot of coronavirus flaring in Europe. And, you know, the way that I would describe it is through the Financial Times, which had an article that came out. It talked about Europe going into a double dip. Economists are warning that these rising coronavirus infections and the restrictions that governments are putting on as a result of that to restrict people's movements, that's really going to dent the recovery. And we're talking about Germany, France, the UK, Italy, Spain, Netherlands, Belgium, a whole raft of different countries that are putting on these kinds of restrictions. I saw an article earlier today about Wales going through a national lockdown. So the whole region of 2.3 million people, there was a region of 2.3 million people that was being locked down. Now it's the entirety of Wales being locked down. Obviously, that's going to be very negative for a growth in the UK. Right. And so really, what the WHO is saying, Europe, if they don't get the coronavirus under control, if they don't take measures at all, you could see a wave in Europe in the fall through to January that it sees death rates five times the level that they were in the first wave. So if you remember Italy and Spain and the UK and places like that, the things that were happening there, they're talking about overall five times the level of mortality. So that's really caused people to start to think we need to do something here.
Yeah. And a question I would very much like to ask you, as you weigh all of the models that are in place elsewhere in the world and you evaluate the relative strengths and weaknesses, both on the healthcare policy side and on the economic and industrial policy side, what do you think is emerging as the suite of best practices to control the virus? I know we talked about Sweden in the past. You're interested in Norway as well. Obviously, you're following very closely what's happening here in the US, the successes that the Chinese have had, notwithstanding the fact that they don't have this sort of open society that we do, and it's easier for the command sector of the economy to control things. What are your insights about what's working and what's not working?
Yeah, so you know, we had a big debate on the feed from Friday when I was talking about Sweden.
Yeah.
And you know, I think it is probably time for me to give up using Sweden as any sort of example, because first of all, it's controversial in general, but secondly, they did very horribly at the beginning of the coronavirus by not locking down, and even now, of the four Nordic countries, they're in third place in terms of the creeping up of infection rates. So I wouldn't necessarily use Sweden as the example. I think that where they're the example is where, you know, from the beginning, they've tried to say that it's a balancing act between how well you keep your economy open and how well you control the disease. But in terms of actual execution of the disease, I would say that, you know, you've hit on two or three countries there that I would look to. China has done an incredible job, as we just talked about, but they've taken very harsh authoritarian measures to get there. That's simply not possible in Western style democracies. New Zealand has done the best job of all the Western democracies or Western style democracies, but they're an island nation and they can take advantage of the fact that they you have to fly in order to get to New Zealand, and they can control the borders very assiduously as a result of that. Of the countries that are integrated within the Schengen area and, you know, where they have more open borders, I would say that Norway is superior to Sweden. And, you know, this goes back to the comments that we had in the comment section from our Friday DB. I'll definitely say mea culpa for taking the whole Sweden paradigm a little bit too far. And Henrik, I'll call him out in particular for talking about, no, let's not use Sweden as an example. Use another country. Norway is a perfect example. If you look at the numbers before, they did the lockdown. They did an incredible job on the lockdown. And if you look at the numbers now in terms of the infection rates, Norway is doing the best of the Nordic countries. Norway followed by Finland, followed by Sweden, followed by Denmark. So I would say that they are the ones that are doing the contact tracing, the testing, and also all of the social distancing protocols that are necessary to keep that balance that we're talking about.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know ya at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
All right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
You know, there are just so many moving parts. This is so incredibly difficult to do in real time. And unfortunately, the decisions need to be made in real time. You know, it reminds me of the quote, we're talking about Asia, Cho En Lai. What do you think about the French Revolution? Too soon to tell. Unfortunately, we need to make these decisions very quickly in order to save lives and to preserve the economy. So it's very challenging. It's also probably worth thinking about the differences between the ROC, the Republic of China, Taiwan, and the PRC, mainland China. Taiwan has also had some great successes. But precisely as you say, Ed, about New Zealand, obviously a small island nation, easy to quarantine, much easier to manage borders somewhere where you're surrounded by ocean. It's a very difficult and challenging time. You know, the more that I read about Sweden, one of the things that it seems is one of the great unknowns here is this question of herd immunity. There are some who speak of herd immunity as the great saving grace that is ultimately going to begin the end of this crisis. And on the flip side, there are people who talk about herd immunity as this magic pixie dust that people are attributing magical powers to that's simply not going to arise. And these are people in the healthcare community. So it's very challenging to understand where all the moving parts come down, where all the variables sort out, and very challenging to have to make those decisions in real time when people's lives are at stake and the economy continuing to function. It is a very challenging time.
It is. And this whole concept of herd immunity, the problem with the herd immunity, I think it's twofold. One, it has to do with the number of people that you put at risk and the mortality rate associated with thinking about herd immunity as sort of the end game. But the second, which I find more pernicious, is mutation. Interestingly, there was an article in Swedish that I read very recently talking about the fact that they found in Sweden one of the first cases of reinfection. And this is a person who got infected in May and then was reinfected in August by the coronavirus. This person actually, when they looked at, they sampled the coronavirus strains that they were infected by, the difference between the first strain and the second strain was 10 different areas where the coronavirus had mutated. In fact, the mutation was large enough for them to say that essentially it's as if this person was infected, not reinfected, but infected twice by two different coronavirus strains. And so when you think about herd immunity and the whole concept that you become immune, well, how long do you become immune? And if all the people in the population are being exposed to the virus, the more people that get exposed, the more mutation you have, and therefore the more likely that re-exposure to coronavirus will result in a reinfection. So again, you know, the whole thing is very murky. We're still in the beginning of this. And I think that the best thing that we could do is concentrate on any new normal go forward strategy that can last for months and years into the future without people having what I would consider policy fatigue. Because policy fatigue, which is what we've seen all throughout Europe, all throughout North America, that's where people stop following the rules. And then you get the R factors going over one. And then you have these lockdowns as a result. And that's negative for everyone.
Yeah, I mean, I'm, you know, regard this with such great humility in terms of the way that I approach it. It's very clear that there's considerable disagreement in the medical community, the people who know this best. And, you know, then you get two guys like us who are much more comfortable talking about finance and economics. And there's always a risk of getting out over our skis here when we talk about this. But at the same time, this really is the key driver of everything that's happening in the global economy. And there's really no choice but to dive in and try and do the best that we can as we analyze and quantify what's happening with the disease, with the data points, and also the consequent numbers that are coming out in the wake of those results. There's just no choice but to have to dive in and discuss it.
Yeah, and let me just say, if you want to be forward looking and then put the pinpoint on it in terms of the finance and the economics. The Europeans, we've seen the numbers go up in Europe. They've been creeping up, and now that people are going in, they're going up in a big way, and it's created a backlash in terms of these lockdowns. And at the same time, the WHO is talking about mortality rates mushrooming there. If that's what's going on in Europe, is it not true that we should expect the exact same thing to happen in the United States, given the amount of policy fatigue that we've seen in the American populace? You think about the outbreak that's actually happening right now in the upper Midwest. We're talking about places like Montana, North Dakota, South Dakota, Michigan, Wisconsin. Those are places where the levels are going up. I would suspect that if what the WHO is saying for Europe is true, then it's equally true for the United States. And at some point, those states, they're going to face the question, do they lock down? Do they take a draconian solution or do they let those numbers spiral out of control? I believe at some point, a combination of consumer behavior and government mandates will mean that there's going to be an incredible amount of lost production and lost consumption because of policy fatigue, people just not following the rules. So the downside risk, as much as it is for Europe in terms of a double dip, it also exists for the United States. I think that's negative for risk assets. Yeah. And I think that's bullish for safe assets like U.S. Treasury securities. So where we are now in terms of, approaching 80 basis points on the 10-year, I think you could see that number fall, get cut in half at some point over the next 3 to 6 months.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems at very least it would be naive not to consider that a possibility after what we've seen in Europe in terms of a double dip. Let me switch gears here a little bit, maybe something to that I'm more comfortable talking about. There's an article out, and call this under the category title, perhaps you heard it here first. We've been talking about commercial real estate, especially commercial real estate here in New York City. There was a great article in today's Wall Street Journal. I think the print edition of today's Wall Street Journal came out last night. And it's worth quoting extensively here because I think the numbers are quite compelling. Quote, nationwide, signs of stress are mounting. Prices on lower rated commercial mortgage bonds nationwide have fallen in recent weeks. The extra yield or spread investors demand to hold a double B rated CMBS bond over 10-year U.S. Treasuries climbed nearly 20 percentage points as of Thursday, according to data from the firm Tripp, to their widest levels since the financial crisis. Some bonds have fallen from 70 cents to 50 cents on the dollar, depending upon the industry and credit rating, bankers said. In aggregate, more than $3 billion worth of loans backing commercial property in the five boroughs are delinquent. That's here in New York City, according to Trapp. And loans in credit negotiations total an additional $4 billion. This is significant, significant money.
Yeah. So, I mean, when we talk about the unfolding, and we talk about the, the bankruptcy, what does Raoul call it? I think he calls it something like the bankruptcy phase.
Insolvency, I mean, I think.
Insolvency, right. Yeah. That's exactly where we are now in terms of thinking of that, because the knock-on effects of all these things are, financial instability, a potential financial crisis. All of these things come together, lost consumption, lost production, credit spreads widening, and then eventually bankruptcy, insolvency, liquidation, et cetera. And then at the same time, you have the policy response. I mean, what's happening in the United States, not just in terms of the healthcare response, but as you were saying, people are talking about no stimulus. So when does that impasse become a problem? I think that we really do have to think of a lot of downside risk in the U.S. in particular, because this is a problem which is likely to go on for a considerable period of time.
Yeah, very much. And, to continue forward, this just continues, right? So appraisals this year on more than 100 struggling buildings with commercial mortgage debt showed property values fell 27% on average, according to data from Wells Fargo. It goes on to discuss the potential link throughs to other aspects of the economy coming in 2021. You know, those of us who were here for the financial crisis remember, I believe, in July of 2007, that a series of Bear Stearns hedge funds failed. And that was probably the first major canary in the coal mine during the great financial crisis. And at the time, this was something that was really sloughed off. It was something that was, that's isolated. This is idiosyncratic. This is something that just these particular funds have exposure to. And of course, we later learned that that simply was not the case. This was something that was very much at the core of the financial system. Now, I'm not suggesting that that's necessarily going to be the case this time, but commercial real estate, CMBS, it's something to keep an eye on. And these numbers are significant.
Yeah, and don't say you're not suggesting necessarily, but right. Really, what you're saying is that the downside risk is there. It's severe. People exactly. Think that we can get through a pandemic, and we can be off to the races on risk assets in the economy, and it's as if it never happened. And we're not even fully the way through. Now we're in a second wave. I mean, there is going to be a reckoning as a result of that. And rather than continue down this path of negativity on the public policy side, let me give you a different spin, because I spoke to a guy earlier today, Joel Greenblatt, who is a money manager. And he's saying to himself, look, I'm a money manager. And it's not like managing money is the best thing in the world in terms of the things that we're doing to help society. But I want to give back in some capacity. And let me give you some ideas about public policy that we can use going forward, things that we can help in terms of education, that we can help in terms of technology, retirement savings, and also fixing the financial system. So great interview to talk to him today, you know, much more upbeat than the kinds of things that we're talking to. So there are some solutions out there. Yeah. And hopefully, you know, when this goes up in a few days, people will think, yeah, this is an optimistic view. Here are some solutions we can pick from.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be a compelling piece. I'm really looking forward to seeing it. I guess I would just add, maybe with a touch of cynicism, that in order to search for solutions, you need to have something before that, which is the recognition that there is a problem.
Right. Yeah.
And when we think about our lifetimes, our parents' lifetimes, our grandparents' lifetimes, even in the most just like fundamental and colloquial sense, the United States led the world out of crisis. And when you look at these numbers from China, and I'm not being gloom and doom here, and I'm not saying that this is an irretrievable path that we've gone down and that it's inexorable, but you need to start thinking about recalibrating public policy to ensure that the United States remains a superpower into the 21st century. Hard to believe that we're at a point where we're saying those words, but you know, it's something that we really need to think about. And I'm really interested in seeing your piece and hearing about some of these potential solutions, because we really need to be looking for them.
Yeah, and that does harken back to what I was talking about in terms of what's happening in Asia. You know, there is a future that I can see out there in which, you know, that whole sphere coalesces around a China-centric model that leaves the United States and Europe to the side. And that's not one in which, you know, America is necessarily flourishing. But again, to go on the positive, Joel Greenblatt, he had some more positive things to say that weren't even policy oriented. He was talking about you and me, the average investor, what we can do. He was saying, you know, I'm a long-term investor, right? If I were running a fund, which I am, I have to worry about the people who are in that fund. You know, if I underperform at one particular time, over a quarter, over a year, over 18 months, whatever it might be, people are going to start pulling their money. But you and I, Ash, we can have a much longer term time horizon. The key is not to get caught up in the short term. Think about what the long term is. He was very bullish, actually, on what he would call growth value stocks, I guess, meaning that, you know, when you think about growth and value, he doesn't think of them necessarily as being independent from one another. There are many places where the froth is not, where you can pick up some value. And if you think from a longer term perspective, he doesn't think those companies are overvalued at all. So very positive. And since he's one of the, you know, the biggest value investors out there that's existed, I took note when he said those things.
Yeah, very much. You know, talking about the search for solutions, our own CEO and co-founder is out today with a new piece on Bitcoin called The Life Raft, away from, and he's talking about it as a life raft away from central bank digital currencies. It's a really compelling piece. If you are a Real Vision subscriber, it's on the platform now. Check it out. I think we're talking about getting it out to a broader audience. But you basically can hear Raoul's big picture thesis about how Bitcoin is the cockroach of finance. It's impossible to kill. And he looks at it from the perspective of a transitional phase between the legacy financial system, which he sees us in today, moving toward a new digital financial system powered by central bank digital currencies in the future. And that this could really be a transitional phase and a place potentially where investors can look and at least think about what their own situation is and assess that area. It's a really compelling piece, I think.
Interesting. You know, I think Jack, he was telling me about that earlier today. And also, I did see that Bitcoin went to 12,000 or is near 12,000. So there's been some recent upside. So people might be interested in that. Yeah, very interesting. And, you know, from my own personal journey that I've become more interested in that space personally.
We got to get you on the crypto platform, Ed. When do you do your first piece?
And yeah, you know, like if you and I, we won't be talking, but we got to get you wearing your shirt too.
I think that must be the source of your optimism today. Putting it on
made me feel good, I have to say, Ash. And I'll feel better if I have it on and you have it on at the same time.
We will definitely plan that. I was shocked when you pulled that. I had no idea that you were wearing it under the jacket.
Yeah, I just got it today. So I ran upstairs and got it. I was like, let me put this on right now.
Well done, Ed.
Yeah, great to talk to you as usual, Ash.
Thanks for joining us.